Hi guys, I'm Danat Hanbali and this is Something to Consider. What if I told you the most important negotiations you'll ever have is actually not with others, but with yourself? Especially in moments when you're trying to find peace, clarity, maybe even courage. A wise woman once said, "From the moment we have a need and there is someone holding it back, that is the start of a negotiation." And as most of you know, I make it a point to surround myself with brilliant humans who challenge me to look at things from an alternative perspective and give me something to consider. And I think that is what today's guest will bring to this conversation. Luzine Mehrabi is a world-renowned professional negotiator, trainer, and speaker, recognized as one of the most influential voices in negotiation. With experience leading high-stakes negotiations, think billion-dollar IPOs and peace-building efforts, Luzine combines technical mastery with unparalleled emotional intelligence. Beyond her professional achievements, she's also a powerful advocate for resilience, courage, and personal growth, sharing her own deeply personal journey navigating life's challenges, including her son's diagnosis with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Luzine's story and strategies challenge us to rethink negotiation, not just as a business skill, but as a way to make peace with ourselves and those around us. Luzine, welcome to the show.
Thank you. What a beautiful introduction.
You deserve it. That was just touching the surface. I got to say, you know, I was really excited to have you on the show. I met you, I would say, officially about a month ago, but I think we've been talking for the past couple of months. I attended a workshop of yours on practical skills for negotiation in entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that resonated most with me was your willingness to be vulnerable in such an incredibly, or at least what feels like an incredibly high stakes, technical, rigid type of setting. So on that note, I'd actually like to start off with you giving the audience a little bit of context. What would you share about the context of your life that sets the stage for who you are as a woman today?
Ooh, deep question. My background was in finance. So I grew up in that very analytical, factual world. I was on trading floors for 15 years of investment banks and the stock exchange. So there is no place for emotion there, right? Like we're extremely rational and it's all about numbers and Excel sheets. Mm-hmm. It's when my second child was born, my daughter, and I went on maternity leave and I came back and I realized that for the 4 or 5 months that I was gone, I hadn't looked at the stock exchange one time, not once.
Wow.
Whereas while I was behind my 7-8 screens, I was looking at it 10 times a second. And that's when I realized if I can be so passionate about something that obviously I don't really care about, imagine when I do add the emotional intelligence, the human aspect, and all the other things that make life so colorful, imagine how life could be then. Mm. And that was the beginning of me contemplating I need to leave this world and do something else.
Wow. That's powerful. You know, we often think of negotiation as something that we do with other people. But a lot of what you talk about, even in your online content, is negotiating peace with yourself. Mm. And I think I kind of want to challenge you on that. What does that even mean? What does it mean to negotiate with yourself or in an attempt to have peace with yourself? Especially, I mean, I find that, you know, when we're talking or thinking about ourselves and our own circumstances, it can get quite overwhelming to be in one's head. So what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, we already are in our own heads. We already are talking to ourselves. We already are negotiating with ourselves. So just bringing a light to it and making people aware of it can then help them push it in the direction that would serve them. Because from the second you wake up, you have inner negotiations all day long, every day. Mm. For example, you say, I want to wake up at 5 a.m. And you set your alarm at 5 a.m. And alarm rings and you don't feel like waking up. Boom, you're in a negotiation. The part of you that says, get up and do the thing you wanted to do. And the part that says, oh, I want to stay in my comfy bed. That's an inner negotiation right there. And then that happens tens of thousands of times per year. And like all the time, you have inner negotiations in your head, meaning you want something and another part of you wants something else. So by realizing, hey, wait a second, there's a dialogue happening, we can then use the same negotiation skills I teach to negotiate with other people, with yourself, and come to peace with yourself. I think the biggest achievement we can achieve in life is being at peace with who we are, with what we do, with how we do it, and our past. So there's a lot of forgiveness that comes into play, of letting go of the past, of accepting the past, of letting things and letting people be.
Mm.
And there's a lot of love and all these other things that come into play to come to a place of peace where you say, you know what? I accept who I am. I accept my past, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I accept where I am today and where I want to go. I accept who I am, including all my flaws. I accept everything I've done, and I'm at peace with it.
Mm.
It's okay. Because when you're there, and I've only recently started to scratching the surface of that amazing feeling, it just makes you so extremely calm and powerful.
Mm-hmm. You know, I find that interesting. A lot of that resonates with me, but I find it interesting because it almost feels like the antithesis of how the world asks us to participate in it. I feel like we live in a time where it is about standing your ground, not moving, not compromising, even if it is with the intention of taking something in return. Why should one compromise if we're talking about it in the context of a relationship or in the context of a business sometimes? It is your belief that matters most, which in principle, I mean, the reason why that narrative is there is to evoke a sense of confidence or at least reassure you that, you know, where you stand is valid. But it feels like it's also a difficult pretense to live in a world where give and take is very much part of the, you know, our nature.
Mm-hmm. It is, and it always will be. Like, there's no such thing as never compromise.
Mm.
But I want to, again, even challenge the notion of compromise. When we're talking about, I'm going to give you something so that I receive something in return, that's not necessarily compromise. That's just logic thinking and logic sense and just the normal human behavior that we all do. If it's, I want one, you want 10, and we're going to cut the pie in half and do 5, that's nonsense compromise. That doesn't work, and that's not what negotiation really is. I can share you a story, actually, about it. I was just talking to my mom about it before I came here. It is the worst negotiation I've ever heard, which was super traumatizing for me.
Hmm.
I've never shared this anywhere. So one of the worst negotiations I've ever heard is when I was about 7 years old. We had left my country at war and we were living in a refugee camp.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Now, we were not in tents and stuff. This was in a European country where we were, you know, well received. But we were 6 people. My parents had 4 children. And we were in one tiny room with 3, you know, those double beds. Those bunker beds, how do you say that in
bunk
English?
Bunk beds.
Bunk beds. And I was sleeping up.
Mm-hmm.
And as a chronic night owl, it was late at night and I was hearing my parents talk to each other. And my mom was saying, I'm not comfortable here. I'm afraid here. I want to go back. And my father said, I'm not going back. Mm-hmm. And she's like, but what are we going to do? And this is a new country and I don't speak the language and we don't have any money. And all those difficulties and the stress that she had, thinking, what am I going to do with 4 children in a new country that I don't know? And my father said something, Dana, that is for me the example of the worst negotiation ever. He said, listen, I'm staying. If you want to go, you can go. Take 2 children with you and I keep the 2 others.
Oof.
Oof. So me, immediately I'm thinking, oh my God, am I going to go back? Am I staying? Which ones of my siblings am I not going to see anymore? What's going to happen? We're cutting the family in half.
Wow.
Speaking of compromise, take 2, I keep 2. Like, that is the worst thing ever. Mm. And I believe this is the type of techniques that we apply unconsciously, thinking that is what compromise is. That is what a good negotiation is, but it is the worst. Mm. This is the type of things we do when we don't know how to negotiate. When the stress of the conflict is so big that we think we do 50-50 and that's it. Whereas a real negotiation is taking the time to understand what is at stake, what truly matters to the other party, what truly matters to me, and what would be a solution that makes sense and is fair for everybody involved. And that might be 90-10. That might be none of the cake. That might be you have the whole cake and I actually need something else. That might be you take the cherries on the cake and I take the flour or whatever, you know? We need to come out of this 50-50 mindset and thinking that's win-win. It's not. And go into needs. What is your need? What is my need? Get rid of the ego, get rid of the wants, get rid of the nice to haves, and go to the need. What is the core need that we're trying to satisfy? And how can we do that in a fair way so that afterwards we both feel like this is something I can live with? We can still look each other in the eyes and we can even do business with each other later again.
Wow, that's such a mind shift, because even the term fair in my eyes would be 50-50. But the way that you're talking about it here, it is literally about your need being met versus you getting half.
Exactly, because who says half is fair? Imagine you want to sell me your house and it's valued at $1 million. And I come in and I say, but my offer is 500 because that's literally my entire life saving. And you're like, hey, the house is valued at $1 million. Like, I don't care about what's, you know, your budget and this and that. So if we were to say, okay, let's stretch it to 750, that's not fair to you to sell your house at 750 if it's been valued at $1 million.
Yeah.
And I don't even have that 750. So maybe I need to go rob a bank to get to that 750. Like, what's fair in that? You see what I mean? Yeah. It's nonsense to think 50-50 is great, because it rarely is. That one. And two, even the word compromise. In trainings, I often ask, who likes to compromise?
No one.
Nobody. Nobody. But it's been put in our head that compromise is a good thing and 50-50 is a good thing and meeting in the middle is a good thing. That's nonsense. That's if you don't know how to negotiate, you think that's a right approach. But it's not. Instead of wanting things to be 50-50, we need to want to make things fair. And that is by satisfying needs.
Interesting. So how do you think emotional intelligence, or the what does the role of emotional intelligence really play in navigating something like this? Because I'm even imagining it on a level of just the relationship that I am with. And I want to shift my mindset. So where does, emotional intelligence, how would you navigate that?
Yeah, I always say emotional intelligence and negotiation go hand in hand. Like, it's the exact same thing. You cannot be a good negotiator if you don't have emotional intelligence. Because every single skill that is needed to be a good negotiator is part of emotional intelligence. For example, being agile, being able to adapt to what's happening on a negotiation table. Empathy, being able to bond with other people. Flexibility in your positions and willing to review, active listening. And I can give you 15 others. It's all emotional intelligence. It's all basically how to be a good human. It's how to interact with other people. You know, we can look at these tough negotiations that being done, you know, in whether it's in politics, in the media, or anyways, where we have leaderships that are you know, extremely tough and toxic, and be it narcissistic or psychopaths or whatever, because we have those in leadership everywhere. We have loads of those in politics. And you see them negotiate a deal and you think, oh, that's the way it should be done. Well, no, they are using their authority to come to agreements. And I can guarantee you that anyone on the other side is not satisfied. It doesn't feel like they were listened to or that it's fair or whatever. But we're pushing things forward from the sake of this is my role. I am the president, therefore I dictate the negotiation. But in everyday life, in business negotiations, that's not how things are done.
Interesting. So what is the line between having a command of emotional intelligence and manipulation?
Good one. Well, even there, I want to debunk the myth of manipulation by being a bad thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing, and we all manipulate.
To an extent.
We all manipulate. Like, it's whenever you want to get something done and you position yourself in a way that is a bit more favorable than it is in reality, or whenever you tweak the truth a little bit, like, you're manipulating. But it's not necessarily a bad thing. For example, I always say, if you're a parent, you're a manipulator. Why? Because we tell stuff to our kids all the time to get them to do things. that, you know, when we speak about the Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus or Easter Bunny or whatever, like, we know it's nonsense and yet we say it, right? I hope no children are listening to this podcast. No. I don't want to ruin anything.
They're watching other things, don't worry.
So it is a form of manipulation and it's okay. What matters is the intention.
Mm.
Is your intention to deliberately manipulate someone and get them to do things based on false information?
Ah.
That is the typical manipulation that we're talking about, that certain personality types use all the time. Mm. In order for their own gain, they say and do whatever needs to be said and done, whether that's true or not, whether they're hurting people or not. And of course, that's horrible and very toxic. But a tint of manipulation where the intention is good is something that we all do. It's same with us lying. Like, we all lie all the time.
Mm.
But we don't dare admitting it.
Yeah,
you can call it a little lie. You can lie. But anything that is not 100% truth is a lie.
Mm-hmm. And probably would border into this line of coercion more than even persuasion.
Exactly.
That being said, in these high stakes moments, whether it's business or life, you know, getting overwhelmed is a feeling that's I mean, it's hard to separate yourself from, especially when your need, your want is something you're very attached to. And I remember one of the things that you said in your workshop was that the decision maker is the person that should not be part of the negotiation, which I want to hear more about. But also, I'm interested to understand, how does one find calm and clarity in something that is, that feels at least very high stakes?
Mm. Yeah, well, it's not easy.
Mm.
But having the mindset of looking for it is already step one. And knowing that overwhelm is a physiological reaction of what's happening inside of your brain when you have to process too many informations at the same time and think you don't have control. Because whenever there is overwhelm, there's a form of lack of control. Those two go hand in hand. So there's two things. There's one, how can I calm my body physiologically?
Mm-hmm.
And that can happen through breathing exercises, that can happen through taking a break, that can happen through leaving the room you're in for a second and just recollect your thoughts again. So physiologically removing yourself from whatever that is creating overwhelm. Now, if it's not somebody else, but it's yourself because of your thinking, then there is the lack of control part. So then we have to, since it starts in the head, we need to go in the head and challenge it. Mm. Like, really? Really? So physiologically, that's the shortcut. That goes faster by doing breathing exercises, by removing yourself from the source of stress, by and then adding the control part of renegotiating with yourself all the stuff that is bringing you to the overwhelm. Like, is this really true? And also not giving so much power to other people. I see this on the negotiation table all the time. Like, people being so attached to their need or their want that, first of all, they don't even have clarity between a difference between a need and a want.
Mm.
That's a big one. Often it's a want. It's not a need. You will survive without.
Mm.
And second of all, giving all their power away of saying, I need this from you.
Ooh, talk about that a little bit. What do you mean?
How many times did you want something and in your head you believe there's only one person that can give it. There's only one job that can give it. There's only one position that can give it. There's only one amount that would satisfy that want.
Mm.
And I want to say want because it's not a need. Whereas if you take a step back and say, what is the need that I'm truly trying to satisfy here, which is never a number, then you will see that it's rarely only one person on earth that can satisfy that need, that you have way more power to satisfy that need yourself, and that you are way less dependent than you actually think.
Mm. Wow, that's so powerful as a statement, because that even takes away this idea that the power to get that need is not in your hands. It's actually very much in your hands.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Mm. And sometimes we need to learn to accept what we have and where we would be without that need being satisfied. Because often that's where the gold is. That's where the lessons is. Often we need something because we're trying to avoid something else.
Mm.
Whereas if you would just to sit with that something else, that's where you grow your inner power. Because now you transform your need into a want.
Mm.
And then there is a million ways to satisfy that. But we need to let go of that grip of like, it's this or nothing else. And take a step back and saying, why is this so important? And what is the need you're trying to either satisfy or avoid feeling?
Mm-hmm. And why? What is the insight behind the decision maker not being capable of doing that in a room for a negotiation?
Ah, well, that is a question that would take me a long while to answer, because there are, I can give you from the top of my mind like this, 10 reasons why a decision maker should not be part of a negotiation.
Mm.
And even this is counter intuitive, right? People often think, oh, the CEO should be there, right? Yeah. Etc. But that's nonsense.
Can I just, I want to add to that, just to give you context as to why I'm asking this question.
Mm-hmm.
The argument in my head of, I appreciate the insight, but logically, as a business owner, no one's going to fight for my need better than myself, more than myself. So the premise of me not even being there, I mean, that's what I find intimidating, funny enough.
Mm.
That's why I'm asking the question.
Interesting. So as a business owner, you think if I send somebody else in to negotiate on my behalf, they would never go as far as me?
Yes.
It's interesting,
isn't it? Good point. Okay, yeah, I guess, yeah, yeah. Okay, interesting.
What if they would go way further?
Way further, but also just me saying that, how far would I go to get what I want?
That, yeah, also. And who says that's the limit?
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. We are very afraid as business owners to let somebody else take care of our baby.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's the same with parents. Whereas, and I think this is extremely humbling, when I, maybe with a slight touch of deliberate rebellious act of me, a part of me asks you, who says you are the best person to take care of your baby?
Oh, wow.
It's a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I'm asking this to parents, and I'm asking this to business owners. Who says you are the best person to take care of your baby?
That's so interesting. Someone told me this recently about parents. Parents know what's good for you, but they don't always know what's best for you.
Beautiful.
And it's an interesting, yeah, I never thought of it that way.
Yes, absolutely. Now, if you want to take it back to the business negotiations, why should a decision maker not be involved? I can give you 10 reasons. The most important one is that a decision maker should always have the strategic overview of why are we in this negotiation?
Mm-hmm.
Where does this negotiation play a role in our business strategy, in whatever we're doing in different countries, in different years, in different business lines? That is the role of the decision maker, to have this overview of, okay, what is happening? The decision maker is responsible for the decisions, is responsible for the strategy, for the direction, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Whereas a negotiator doesn't necessarily need to have all that information. A negotiator should know the details of the deal, of what are the numbers, what is the market position, where does this play a role within the framework that I have.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so negotiators are kind of like lawyers. They need to know every nitty-gritty detail of that case. That's one thing. Whenever you as a decision maker go in, you're now part of the detail world. And then you lose sight of the bigger picture of why are we here. That is one of the reasons. And a second reason is, whenever you have a negotiator involved and it's high stakes and there are some emotions involved or things go wrong, you can always pull back the negotiator and replace him with another one.
Mm.
Whereas the decision maker is the decision maker. If the decision maker makes a mistake, says something he or she regrets, goes too far, commits to something they can't deliver on, boom, what do you do then?
Yeah.
You don't have a backup. You don't have a way out. You don't have this possibility to say, it was the person and not the case.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we're going to put in someone else and still save the case. So that is a second reason. A third reason is the emotional attachment. Often as a business owner, this is literally your baby. You created this from scratch, whether it's been 1 year or 10 years that you have it. So you are emotionally attached. So if as a counterpart, I know that, I immediately know that's one of your weaknesses and I can play on it.
Mm.
Because if I come in and I start saying bad things about you as a business owner or your business specifically or anything that your business is doing, it would hurt you, the creator of it, much more than it would hurt a negotiator who is there just to negotiate the deal. That person is not emotionally involved and therefore has less buttons to push.
Yeah. Fair point. Fair point. And I feel like one of the things, if I'm being honest, as a woman, that has been the most challenging are the spaces where I've had to negotiate things that are incredibly, incredibly personal for me. And in those moments of trying to get my need met, I cannot help but show that vulnerability. And time again, that vulnerability is used against me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to navigate because while I appreciate where that comes from, and I don't want to resent myself for being able to do that. I don't think it takes away from my strength, but yeah, I mean, I understand the value of having someone in there to support.
Yeah. So in this case, it's not even a gender thing. It's mm-hmm. because you are personally invested. You are emotionally attached mm-hmm. to the thing you're negotiating and the outcome more than anybody else. Mm-hmm. So even if you were to send in a negotiator that is a woman, she wouldn't be as much emotionally impacted.
True.
So it's not the gender thing. It's your baby.
True.
And you don't want to negotiate when it's your baby. It's always more difficult to negotiate something where we have an emotional attachment than to negotiate something that is just numbers and figures.
100%. I mean, on that note, you've spoken a lot about your son's diagnosis, which I can only imagine is an incredibly life-changing thing to happen in your life. How did that change the way that you see resilience, not just as a concept, but in the way that you live your life every day?
Well, my son was diagnosed a few years ago with a fatal condition called Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which breaks down his muscles. He's now 13 years old. He's in a wheelchair. And this disease will continue to break down his muscles until at one point he can't move anything anymore. That is today the reality of this horrible condition. There is no cure yet. Life expectancy is somewhere in the 20s. And the doctors basically are saying, go create great memories and pray for a cure. Now, having to live with that every single day and seeing him literally deteriorate in front of my eyes, I was obliged to change me so that I could face this. Because the woman I was when we got the diagnosis, imagine I'm Miss Finance, working on trading floors, my whole world is analytical, it's all about numbers. And here I'm faced with something that broke my heart into a million pieces. And I could either give up, become ice cold, and go into that analytical frame and try to, you know, find solutions rationally, or allow that opening of my heart to let the heart do what it does best, and that is connect you to your true inner strength that comes from a place of love. And I think that is the biggest gift anybody can experience, where you break your heart open, you go through all the walls that we've created, all the defense mechanisms, you go straight in it, you break it open, and you say, show me. Show me, heart, how can I do this? So when I went on that journey of saying, okay, I need to change myself, otherwise I'm just literally going to go crazy with this, I learned to listen to my heart, which sounds very cheesy, or I don't know how it sounds, but that is what I did, because with my mind alone, I was not able to fix this, to solve this. This wasn't a mathematical equation that I could put in Excel and get a solution for.
Mm-hmm.
There had to be another way. And that was through the heart, through feeling, of saying this hurts so much, of seeing my son suffer and there's nothing I can do, that I need to find some form of strength and source from somewhere else.
Mm.
And for me, that was through the heart, through feeling, through processing my emotions, through allowing myself to cry, through allowing myself to feel. Because once you start feeling the painful things, there is an end to it. At one point, the pain ends.
Mm.
And you get a break. And you can breathe again. And you can smile again. And you can do fun stuff again. And then you're like, oh, the next painful thing, I can go through it again. It's a bit like labor, really. It's a bit like, it's horrible. But at the end, there is something beautiful. And at the end, you know, okay, you survived. and it's over. And the strength that came with it, it's yours for life. For example, before having this diagnosis, every time I would have physical pain, I would remember I had a baby without painkillers. I can do this, you know? So it gives you like this experience thingy that you can hang on to and say, I've been through this. I've been through this. So now anything difficult that happens, and this year was horrible, was the worst year of my life, even after diagnosis, I always remind myself, I've been through so much difficulties and I'm still standing and I'm still loving and I'm still caring and I still love life. So no matter what comes my way, I know I'll stand back up. I know I'll go through it. And I know, you know, like in the back of my mind, I know what's coming. Like, again, my son's diagnosis is a progressive disease. It gets worse and worse. So unless there is a medical miracle in the years that he lives, I know that the end is that one day I have to see him leave this beautiful planet. That is what I know is waiting for me. And that is the opposite of what any parent wants or how nature is supposed to be, right? So they call it anticipatory grief that I go through. But when you know how to grieve, you become so powerful because then you can handle anything. You can handle anything that will happen in life. You know, you will sit down, you will cry it out, you will feel it out, and then you'll stand back up again. And it's not a linear thing. It's up and down and up and down. And there are days where I'm good. There are days where I'm not good. But I know how to go through the not good. And that's why I'm not afraid of it anymore. I'm not afraid of emotional pain.
Wow. That is so powerful. That is so powerful. And it makes me wonder about the conversations that you have with God.
Oh, they're funny. Oh, there's always an element of humor in the conversations I have with God.
Yeah. I mean, wow. I mean, now that's a negotiation.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. That in itself is a negotiation. What are those conversations like?
I remember my very first negotiation with God is when they told us that something was wrong with Alex, my son, but we didn't have the diagnosis yet. Mm-hmm. It was like the in-between that, you know, probably it could be something bad, but maybe not. So you're like between hope and despair. And I had negotiations with God every single day. I said, God, please, because they told me worst case scenario, it's Duchenne. But they also gave me two other diseases that it could potentially be. And I was like, please, not Duchenne, like anything but Duchenne, please, please. And I was just negotiating. And I said, okay, you want to wake me up? You did it. You want me to do something better with my life than work in finance? Fine. And I said, I'm going to go work for an NGO. I'm going to become a humanitarian. Like, just don't give me Duchenne. Tell me what you want from me and I'll do it. But don't give me a sick child. Like, I can't handle it. So again, I'm only analytical, right? So there were a lot of negotiations. And I remember when we got the diagnosis, it was in Saint-Cloud, a suburb of Paris. I remember I was in the garden and I literally fell on my knees. And I told God, this was not the deal. This was not the deal. I told you not Duchenne. Why is it still Duchenne? And we had the second opinion and it was like 100%. There was no way out. This was it. This was what I was supposed to face. And I say, you think you're all smart, but you made a mistake. I can't do this. I'm not that type of mom. I cannot take care of a child in a wheelchair. Like, what are you doing? You made a mistake. There are so many moms who would do that much better than me. So it was a lot of conversations happening with God, and it took me a while to accept that this was the new chapter of my life, and everything I had thought life would be like until that day was over. So I went through grief again, and I stood back up. But yeah, every day I have negotiations with God, and it's funny. There's always an element of humor And I yell at him and I scream at him and I make peace with him and I apologize. it's funny, but I feel absolutely 100% supported by God. My faith gives me a lot of strength. And there's always also moments where I go to God and say, you know what, you take care of this. Like, it's too heavy. You do it and you tell me what to do. And then I get the insights and I act upon it and I can live with, I did the best I could.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. I love that some of life's best lessons come from the most unexpected places. You've shared this incredibly painful experience. You've shared your relationship to grief. Has there been a specific moment in time that you can think of now that shifted how you see things in terms of the way that you look at life?
Yes. Oh my God. Oh, you're asking such deep questions, Dana. My goodness. I thought, oh, we're just going to talk about negotiations. Yes. The moment where everything shifted for me was the moment where I realized I don't have to live this life. I get to live this life. The life as a special needs mom, the life as a negotiator who can't negotiate my way out of this disease. Because I used to be, I still am, and I'm proud of it, extremely rebellious. Like, I don't take things for granted. I don't accept things as they are until I have, like, investigated it and I come to truth with it. So when we got the diagnosis, I was so angry at God, and I said, this was not the deal. I don't agree with this, and I don't want it. Like, I don't want it. You made a mistake. You're giving me a life. I don't want to live this life. I didn't choose a child with a handicap. You know, like, no, I'm not going to do it. So we were living in France. We decided to move to Dubai, give the best life possible to Alex. And we moved here to Dubai. I built everything. I put him in the best school I could find. You know, rented a beautiful home. And I said, okay, good. The kids are in good hands. My husband is okay. My daughter is fine. They don't need me anymore. I don't want this life. I'm not going to watch my son deteriorate and die. I'm just not going to do it. Like, I'm not that type of mom. I can't do it. It's too heavy. So my goal, and nobody knew this, was to bring them to Dubai, build a beautiful home for them, and then leave. Leave Earth. Leave this life. Like, I'm not going to do it. I was just so angry. So that was the plan. And I actually Googled how to do it.
Wow.
I remember I was lying on my bed and I Googled how to commit suicide and make it look like an accident. Because I wanted them to think it just happened. I didn't even have the courage to tell them that I was going to leave. So when I Googled that, and I deliberately say Google and not the search engine because I want to promote them for what they did. Google gave me the answer. You don't want to die. You want the suffering to end. That was like straight in my heart. So true. I was like, it's true. I don't want to die. I just don't want this. I'd be happy to live another life, but I don't want this life. And realizing that, that was just playing in my head over and over again. You don't want to die. You want the suffering to end. And I hope this will resonate with somebody listening to this podcast and having these type of thoughts, because it's so true. You don't want to die. Nobody's fantasizing death. They just want their suffering to end and they don't see another way out. Like now, I felt like I was forced to take care of a child that was dying and I didn't want that. So what happened was, and this is, you know, Dana, one day I'm going to write an article or a book about the dangers of empathy. It's an all other subject. But what happened here was I shared with my husband what I had Googled. I said, babe, this is what I've Googled. And I was expecting, hoping, empathy, that he would take me in his arms and say, everything's going to be okay, babe. But he didn't. Instead, he became super angry. I saw the rage in his eyes and he said, what about me? What about Elise? That would be so selfish. That was like another wake-up call the same day. And I was like, what? I was expecting some form of compassion. But no, he was super angry. Like, what do you mean? What do you mean you're going to leave? Yeah, like, leave me alone with them?
Wow.
And he said, Luz, you don't have to do this. He wasn't talking about death. He said, you don't have to. You always wanted to go and live in the mountains, which is true, and I still do. He said, go do that. You know, go live in whichever country you want. Go live in the mountains. Go and do whatever you want to do. You don't have to. Like, it's not either you live this life or you don't live at all.
Mm.
There's a third option, which is you live another life. Do that, but at least don't take your life. And I think that is, in the 20 years we've been together, the wisest thing he's ever said to me. Because that is what saved my life. Because it was through those words that I reflected and reflected and saying, you know what? He's right. I don't have to live this life.
Mm.
And anybody going through anything difficult, you don't have to. It's one of the options. And you have many more options. So I could, in that moment, say, I'm going to take my life. Or I could escape and go to the mountains. Or I could stay and take care of my child. And that's what I decided to do. I said, you know what? I am going to stay. I am going to take care of Alex and my husband and my daughter. But I'm going to do it on my terms.
Mm.
That was like the silver lining that came with it, of saying, if I'm going to live this life, then nothing else and nobody else matters. I'm going to do it my way, the way I think is the best to take care of this child, based on what I think he needs. And everything else that other people are saying, including family, doctors, neighbors, other special need parents, comes second. It's me and my child, and I'm going to do it my way, the best I can. And that gave me a form of control back, of saying it's not actually God and everybody and everything against me. I'm here as an active player, and I get to decide how we're going to do this, how we're going to navigate this. Like, everything is new. You're like being put in a new life, and like, good luck with it. And then I was only thinking about, okay, the number of years with him are limited. And I had read this beautiful quote from Abraham Lincoln, who says, and in the end, it's not the years that count. It's the, in your life, it's the life in your years.
Oh,
that's so beautiful, right?
That is beautiful.
That became my motto. I was like, okay, how can we add life to the years that we do have? Because here he was still only 6 years old. He could still walk. He could run. He could do everything still. It was my imagination of the future that was ruining the now. And I thought, okay, right now we can still do everything. So let's go. Let's travel. Let's make memories. Let's take him to all these beautiful places in Dubai and in the region. And that's what we did. We traveled a lot. We've been to loads of countries. So Neil could still walk. We're still traveling and now in a wheelchair. I shifted. That day shifted everything. So this was in September 2017. I will never forget. This dramatically changed my life, of saying, no matter what situation you're in, you can shift it. You can do things differently. If you cannot shift the situation, you can shift the way you deal with it. Mm-hmm. If you cannot shift the way you deal with it, you can shift the way you look at it. Like, do anything you can to make yourself, again, a powerful actor in the story.
Mm-hmm. And in this beautiful poetic way, you may not have gotten what you wanted, but you're getting what you need.
I know, and it's horrible, but the lessons that come with it is what I had to learn, you know, whether that's what God wants me to learn or my soul or however you want to call it. It's, I needed that pain to learn the lessons, to then become another version of me, share the story along the lines, hopefully inspire a few others and, you know, pass it forward.
Wow. You're quite a woman. Mashallah. Bringing this back to a space where you are in a situation where you need to fight for something that you need, and you are having this conversation with someone else who also has a need. However, in between, in this conversation, there are a lot of intangible things at play, things like culture, belief systems, religion, things that are difficult to put a logic to in an attempt at a logical conversation. Maybe even identity, how you see each other. How do you get to opposing sides? I mean, you talked about empathy in the beginning, and you shared a little bit about it in your story, but how do you get to opposing sides that are very stuck in what it is that they need or what they think they need to see each other? And is there a learning there that can potentially teach us about how to resolve conflict?
Absolutely. Well, this is where I'm brought in, right? I'm rarely brought in when everything is going fine. It's always there is a deadlock. They think there's no way out. And they're trying like a last thingy to make it work. Now, the beauty of conflict is that as long as two or several parties are talking to each other, that means there is something that they all need from each other.
If they're still talking.
If they're still talking, yes. But as long as the negotiation is going on, that means they're still talking. And if they're not, we need to change their perception about why being on the negotiation table would be better for them than not. Okay, so we literally pull them to the negotiation table. Once they're on the table, the whole art of negotiation is trying to find what are the things that we would all benefit from if we were to come to an agreement. What is that thing? That is the magical thing that we're looking for. And you can only find that by being extremely willing to understand what matters to them. We're too much preoccupied by what we need. I want this, I want that, I need it by then, I need that number, I need it to reach that goal. But we need to go in almost extremely curious to say, what does the other party need? What could they need? And then ask questions and then put yourself in a position of, I want to find out, I want to discover, I want to understand what matters to you. Because often they're not, even the other party, they don't really understand what they need. But by having this humble approach of saying, you know what, this is what I need, I think. I believe this is what you need. Am I correct? And then start the dialogue of saying, what matters to you? Why does that matter to you? How can we make sure that we can satisfy needs that everybody is happy with without having to give in on things that are non-negotiable, such as values and the cultural aspect that you said, religion, things like that. You know, don't negotiate these type of stuff. Like, that's lost cause. You need to accept and start dialoguing with people from where they are and who they are, and then see what is it in between us. For example, yesterday, I was advising an executive who is in a battle with the employer who wants to let him go, and they were talking about the package, okay? The thing that they have in common, without knowing anything about the numbers and the history and how many years he's been there and all those things, the thing they have in common is they would both benefit from finding a solution without it going to court, right? They would all save reputation, money, time, energy, etc. Now, from one party, it's always more important than for the other. That's what makes it interesting. But they would both benefit from coming to an agreement together before letting the lawyers take over. So that is the thing that we need to find in every negotiation. And in every negotiation, there is one, at least one. There might be several. So always have this mindset of saying, I need to understand what you would benefit from, that I would also benefit from, but that is not the need of the table, because we want different things. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a negotiation.
100%. I almost hear it as this could be seen as a tactic that diffuses the emotional stakes or the high stakes that that are triggering emotions in this situation.
Yes, because I want A, you want B, but we both want some form of C. So if we're both looking in the direction of C, now we're becoming not more adversaries, but we're in the same team because we would both benefit from this thing being resolved. To give you a very clear example, let's say you want to rent, you're here in Dubai, we're renting our homes, and we have to pay sometimes a year check in advance, right? So when you're negotiating and you're renting a house, you want to make sure you have the best price, but your landlord also wants to make sure that he has the best price, right? He or she. Now, when I was renting, for example, a few years ago, we had rented the first year. And as always, when you come to Dubai, the first year you get screwed because you don't know the market well.
Yeah, that's 100%. I can attest to that.
That's just the normal thing. It's part of the game. The second year, you're like, hey, now I understand the market. And now I'm going to negotiate the rent down. Back then, the market was going down. So I said, okay. Now, an error many people make is, first of all, assume that the other party wants to deal with you. Don't assume that. So I'm not going to call and say, hey, since you want to rent your house to us, don't assume that. My first question was, would you like to rent your house to us again?
Oh, that's very humble. Okay.
And it was yes, because you don't know. Maybe he wants to sell it. Maybe he wants to put his cousin in. You don't know. He said yes. And I said, okay. And then you already think upfront of what could be this possible C, meaning something you would both benefit from if you come to an agreement. And then you pronounce it. You actually label it. So I told him, I said, listen, I am thinking of renting your house again as well. if you and I were to come to an agreement, we would both save time, energy, and money. Right?
Mm.
And he says, right. So now you're looking in the same direction of we both want to save money
time.
Because I'm going to have to pay an agent. I'm going to have to, you know, time. I'm going to have to watch, go other viewings and stuff. And I'm going to save effort, time, energy, money, the whole thing. And same thing for him. If he wants to bring in somebody else, you know, he has to, we need to leave. He has to paint the whole house, etc. So this is a common objective that we both have. This is a common interest. This is something we would both benefit from. And from that perspective, the negotiations are already more collaborative than they are competitive.
Mm.
So then I said, okay, if you're going to have to put somebody else in, you need to gonna paint everything, you're going to have to pay this and pay that, let's just bring that towards me. And if I have to move somewhere else and I need to pay for people to move my house and this and that, let's save that money and bring it towards you and come to an amount where I know the actual market value is being reflected, where it's fair what I'm paying and you're receiving what is fair for you too. But you see how talking that
100%
way changes everything?
100%, because it shows that you're considering their, what's in it for them as well as what's in it for you, which in a way diffuses emotional triggers potentially. By the way, I'm so going to use this because my rent's going to be renewed in a couple of months. So I'm so using this.
Voila. But don't make the mistake many people make of saying, oh, I've been paying too much last
demanding
year.
Demanding it, yeah.
Oh, the kitchen thingy is broken. Mm-hmm. They already know that.
They
but
already
nobody
know that.
Nobody wants
care
to hear
it,
those
yeah.
things.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
then you can slip it into the negotiations as it's advancing. But the core thing is you would save time, energy, and money if you stay in that house.
100%.
And your landlord would as well if you stay in that house. So this is an easy one where I'm saying most of the negotiations in the world, whether it's diplomatic negotiations, whether it's high-stakes negotiations, whether I'm doing suicide negotiations, business negotiations, personal negotiations, divorce negotiations, it doesn't matter. Mm. In the majority of cases, there is something that you would all benefit from, and everybody benefits from having a collaborative approach. Most of the negotiations don't have to be competitive at all. But you have to have this mindset of saying, how can I add value instead of only focusing on what can I take from the negotiation table?
I like that. I like that as a mindset shift. And funny enough, I can start to understand now the internal negotiations I have for myself, the value that it's that I'm going to get if I do something specific and how it really is a natural part of my thinking. I just never thought about it before.
Exactly. But when you look at it that way and you realize that you're negotiating constantly with yourself, but you will recognize that you're also constantly negotiating with others. And then when that fear of negotiation and all the negative stuff that we're telling ourselves about negotiation disappears, it becomes just fun and you just try and you just go for it. And sometimes the stakes are not high, so you just play around with it. And it's actually fun. Like, I don't know, I have saved in my life or not spent or pulled towards me millions of dollars. Millions. This is only in my personal life. I'm not even talking about the billions that I've done for my clients. Just in my personal life, from just trying, from just asking, from, you know how many times I get things for free just because I ask. They don't know who I am or whatever. I just ask. Yeah. If they say no, I'm fine with that. It's the fear of rejection that holds us back. It's the wanting to be liked. It's the what will they think. It's all those things that are stopping you from asking for things. Like even just before coming here, I negotiated another thing on my house. The guy said, no, this is really the last price, the last price, the last price. And then in the end, boom, he deducted another 500 dirhams. It's maybe nothing, but I prefer,
it's a win.
I'll take the 500 dirhams. Yeah. You know, it was the last extra thing. And you can do this in a playful way where nobody's angry, nobody's frustrated. They walk away, they're smiling, you know. Most of the times where I'm doing business negotiations, they bring me back in for another deal. Like, you want to leave a negotiation table in a way that the other party feels like they won. That's great. Put your own ego aside. Doesn't matter. You want them to think they won. And you want them to think that you were likable, as in, I want to deal with this person again, because they know that you're reliable. Like, you do what you said you will do. Like, that is a massive win. If you can have that negotiation and you got what you needed, perfect.
Beautiful. Well, Lo, you've given me so much to consider. Lucine, I want to end this episode on a final question. And I ask it to all my guests.
Okay.
If the choice, now the microphone is in your hand, What would you want to ask me? What would you like me to consider today based on the conversation that we had today?
I would like to ask you in an analytical way, if you had to grade it from a level of 0 to 10, where do you think you are in terms of being at peace with yourself?
Oh, wow. That is a fantastic question. And that is a question that every time I think I have the answer to, life throws in a circumstance that tests me. Mm. And I realize, I still have some work to do. I think on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say a seven. I think I'm at a seven, specifically because in this past 2 years specifically, I moved to Dubai 2 years ago, and there were a lot of changes that happened in my life. I feel like the biggest things I was tested on were fundamental things tied to my identity that were rooted in my values. Mm. And I feel like in the times where I felt lost, it was those values that brought me back or gave me the kind of reassurance and safety I needed within myself to keep moving forward. And I recognize that. I still have a lot of work to do, a lot. But that's why I think I would give it a 7. Maybe on some days a 6. But yeah,
on some days an 8.
Yeah.
But that's great. Yeah. That's great. That's amazing. That. And just having the self-awareness is huge. But yeah, I asked that question because I truly believe one of the biggest successes we can achieve, one of the biggest achievements in life is inner peace.
Yeah. Amen to that. Lucine, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing such beautiful insights, being so vulnerable and honest. And you're incredible. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Where can our audience connect with you to find out more information about what you do and if they want to reach out to you in any way?
Yeah, LinkedIn. LinkedIn is the best. I'm starting Instagram. I don't really understand how it works yet, but I'm doing my best.
It takes time to get into it. Awesome. All right, cool. To all our listeners, I want to thank you for the privilege of your time. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I would appreciate a like if you did. And please do share it with anyone that you feel would benefit from this conversation. In the meantime, I hope you found something to consider.